Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, today on the podcast, we have the brilliant David Nabarro. David is co-director and chair of the Institute of Global Health Innovation at Imperial College London. He's had an extraordinary career in public health, working on complex issues that span disease outbreaks, food security, nutrition. In 2018, he won the World Food Prize together with the extraordinary Lawrence Haddad, who we interviewed 2 weeks ago on the podcast. You might remember David's regular appearance in the news during the coronavirus pandemic. In 2020, he was appointed Special Envoy of the WHO Director General on COVID-19. He's also co-lead of the UN Global Crisis Response Group on Food, Energy and Finance. Sustainability has been a key theme throughout his career, curating the Food Systems Summit Dialogues in 2018, and now working as Strategic Director at the 4SD Foundation, providing sustainable development training to leaders in all sectors. Now, given his expertise and passion for sustainable food systems, David is the ideal person to discuss the critical topics of resilience and equitability in the global food system. So today, we'll explore the existing barriers and we'll ask whether our current system is prepared to tackle the challenges ahead. David Nabarro, sorry, that's a huge amount of words, but welcome to the podcast.
I am delighted. I'm tempted to tell you that long introduction was because I was the kind of person who could never hold down jobs for very long. So it was job after job. And the other thing is that I was always given jobs that involved joining things together. So the titles were super long and multisyllabic. And so the shorthand for everybody is Nabarro is one of these people who makes connections work.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, so I wanted to start off by looking at your work a little bit conceptually to begin with, if that's okay. So when I look at all the work you've done, like you go through all these extraordinary job titles, the work you've done on change, innovation and development, I'm struck by the vocabulary of large-scale thinking, of macroeconomics, systemic solutions, phrases such as global, special, strategic, systems, senior. I mean, even one job title had the phrase population advisor in it. So the thing is, humans are microcosms. We're fickle with very individual pressures, fears, needs, desires. We live in complex patchworks of culture, history, geography, family aspirations, expectations. So is it difficult? Is it a constant pressure when working at such a high epidemiological level to remember the person, the individual, the me and the you who are going to have to implement and cope with the change, the innovation, the development that you're working on? How do you balance the two?
Everything is about people. That's the fundamental unit of my work, is the person, the individual, that individual's experience, that individual's opportunity, that individual's destiny. But at the same time, individuals aren't islands. One of the great things about being human is that when we come together, we become a collective. When we're a collective, we behave as a group. When we behave as a group, we can be strong, we can be inspired, we can be transformative. So I'm also interested in how humans behave as groups. And that's what's got me interested in thinking about patterns of behavior and then thinking about the systems within which we humans find ourselves and how those systems actually function to decide whether or not we're going to benefit or not. And I said decide there deliberately because I actually believe that when you've got humans together, there is collective intelligence and collective behavior that we're only beginning, honestly, fully to understand. Folks say, well, artificial intelligence, you know, that'll change everything. I say I'm not sure. Because I think that actually, I certainly, and I'm sure many others, don't fully understand what actually happens when groups of people work together. And so I'm not sure that we're yet at a point where we can tell a machine how humans behave when they're together. I think that's an area where we're just learning, learning, learning. And that's what I am excited by, is the collective behavior of humans as well as what happens to them as individuals.
And when you're working with teams on new ideas, on innovations, is there a dissonance between you coming up with a plan and the implementation of it? Is there always a surprise and a shift in your thinking when you try and implement it because people are fickle and they change their views on things?
Well, Stefan, first of all, I have to just say, I think by and large, I would not use in my description of what I do a term like people are fickle, because I basically start from a sense that people are brilliant. And what actually happens when people are confronted by an issue can usually be explained by meeting people where they really are and tuning into what they're saying and doing and thinking. So I'm basically going to say people are everything. People are, for me, the center of what represents the way to move ahead and to handle massive and complex and tricky existential challenges. Starting from that, I then am looking at what any individual can do to make sure that when a plan is developed and it's implemented, it's also taking account of how people behave when they're in groups and also the circumstances in which they find themselves. And that's why I've got interested in how systems work. You see, no issue that affects an individual or even a community comes on its own and just has a very precise and almost sort of unique laser-like impact on a group of people and not disturbing others. Everything that happens to individuals in a society also has effects beyond those individuals, and that means that there are often unintended consequences of any action. And because of that, I like to think in terms of systems of interacting influence in any community. And because there are these systems, it's also important to recognize that the way in which they behave looks different from the perspective of each individual who's looking at them. Of course, if you've got people with similar beliefs, then they're likely to have similar views of the system. If they have a particular religion or if they've come from a particular trade, they may well have some similar perspective. But fundamentally, I work from the assumption that different people see what's going on through their own eyes and with their own hearts and souls. And so it's that capacity to understand that everybody sees things differently that makes systems working so important. And if you start from that assumption, then moving forward from there takes you down a pathway of working with people as groups rather than working with them as individuals.
Beautifully put. Okay, let's get a little bit more specific. It's been a rough few years for a lot of people. Obviously, we can't ignore these things, the pandemic, cost of living crisis, war in Ukraine, Brexit here in the UK. In your view, what cumulative effects have these events had on people economically, socially, even psychologically?
You mentioned in the introduction that one of my roles is to work with the United Nations Secretary General and his team on what's called the Global Crisis Response Group. In our analysis, we said there's been a succession of shocks affecting people's lives and livelihoods for some time now. And these shocks are coming closer and closer together. They're in a way cascading off each other, and they're having a cumulative impact on the well-being of folk everywhere. That cumulative impact is, in short, leading to poor people getting poorer. It's leading to groups of poor people experiencing a greater difficulty with regard to their access to food, their access to energy, and even their access to services. And some of those poor people are reaching the point where they are so poor, they become what we call food insecure. They are to a point almost of starvation. And that means they are extremely poor and they're in danger. And our analysis is that the proportion of people in our world who've got poorer and the numbers of people who are extremely food insecure have taken an alarming increase in the last 2 or 3 years. And it's because the shocks have come together and have made things bad. Now, I want to stress, it's poor people who are hurting the most. Even in the UK, there are said to be between 17 and 20% of people who are food poor, who can't afford the food they need. But if you go to a poorer country with a lot of poor people, then the percentage who can't afford the food they need might be 50% or 60% or even 70%. And just imagine what that leads to. It leads to a very, very disturbing situation of massively increased levels of poverty. In our world at the moment, the numbers of people who are getting poorer are increasing, and that's leading to a massive increase in poverty and vulnerability. But at the same time, wealthy people are doing fine, and the proportion of people who are getting wealthier is also increasing. It's rather smaller. And overall, there's a growing divide in countries and in the world between wealthy and poor. And the consequences we could talk about, but I can just say in a few words, they're not good. Because they're, unless action is taken collectively by those who are wealthy, the prospects for these people getting poorer are just really very, very dismal indeed.
Well, let's talk about the potential consequences briefly, because in the past, food has been the touch paper for riots. I mean, there've been tortilla riots, there've been bread riots. I mean, and these aren't isolated circumstances. This has happened quite a lot. I'm quite surprised at how few riots there have been, to be honest. Certainly in areas that I know, the UK, France is rioting about different issues, but not about food and poverty necessarily. I mean, deprivation, especially when related to food, can lead to national security problems, can't it? And this can blow up onto a bigger scale. Are we at that level? Is there a tipping point that we're coming to where there will be violence, where the search for resources like water and food, it will turn into a violent conflict between groups trying to get those resources?
Well, Stefan, in my experience, very poor people don't riot. In my experience, the people who riot are people who've been quite wealthy and experience a reduction in their living standards, but they're not in the sort of very poor group. The people who are very poor when money is tight and food is hard to get, they're mostly women, children and older people. And in general, when they're short of food, they sit in the corner of their house trying to find a place of shade, and they don't do much. And then they get sick, and then, unfortunately, they pass on. That's the situation that's occurring in places where there are catastrophic levels of what we call food insecurity. There are identified to be, there are around 7 such places in the world right now. It's more than we usually have. And they tend to be in countries that are experiencing conflict or affected by climate change. And they, people are not, by and large, rioting in those places. I wanted to stress that because I think it does surprise people that with increased poverty and food insecurity and hunger, we're not seeing more riots, but we're not because most of those people are just simply not up to it. And they also lose too much. You see, if you're poor and you riot, you may well end up being detained or you may be under threat. You may also not get food. And so the vital thing, if you're poor, is food for yourself, food for your children, food for your older relative. And honestly, it's easier to get that if you don't riot.
Okay, now you mentioned food security. I mean, it's become a huge concern. We talk about it very frequently on this podcast.
Not surprised. In food matters, I'd expect it to rise up. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. But I wondered, and we've talked about it a lot, and I think we've begun to understand some of the basic components of it. But I wondered what you thought about the twist on this, which is the concept of food sovereignty, which is about countries kind of retreating into themselves. And in a sense, it's an anti-globalization approach that champions domestic production as a solution to food chain fragility. In theory, this should lead to greater value placed on national food cultures. It should, you know, should make countries more resilient. But then the food chain is a complex thing, and it's about spreading the burden of cost as well. Do you think food sovereignty is a good thing or a bad thing?
Thanks. The difficulty about food sovereignty is it does mean different things to different people. And let me just start with another word that you used while you were introducing, and that is the word resilience. If communities are increasingly affected by shortage of rain or long, very hot spells, this is going to disturb their agricultural production. And if their agricultural production is disturbed, then there is a likelihood that they're going to end up being hungry unless they can import food from somewhere else and replace the local production that's been lost. If at the same time your access to imports is disturbed, for example, by the reaction to the COVID pandemic, then your situation is really grim. And that's what happened in quite a lot of countries, particularly countries that were heavily dependent on imports, during the period 2021 through to now. And that's why many governments are saying, hang on, we need to really increase our local production in our local communities. We need to establish stores so that we can keep the food that we produce locally in case we end up having difficulty because the rains fail or the weather goes bad for other reasons. And we also need to be keeping stores in case the boat that normally brings our imports just doesn't turn up because of bad weather or because we're put in quarantine. And that focus on resilience has really shot up. We looked at what's happened in more than 100 countries during the last 2 years, and we find that the issue that they've most emphasized is increasing resilience. Now, you can't increase resilience if at the same time you don't have control over what is happening in your jurisdiction, as we call it. That's the legal entity within which government is being done. And one term that is increasingly used for national governments taking control over what happens food-wise in their jurisdiction is food sovereignty. In its basic sense, it's about being in control. Being in control over what happens when you import, so you're not stuck, basically, dependent on what the exporter puts on the boat, but you'll have some degree of control over what's actually landed and goes into your shops, or some degree of control over how you will grow your seeds and what fertilizers you'll use. That's, for example, in many islands that have told us they're trying to take control over their situation. That's how they're using food sovereignty. A more extreme use of the term food sovereignty is when you say, we're going to do everything ourselves. We're going to become self-sufficient. And that's, I think, less desirable because for many, many situations, you can't produce all the food you're going to need under all circumstances. And so I'm very much discouraging the use of the term food sovereignty when it implies self-sufficiency, particularly in the current kind of situation.
And politicians love talking about being in control, certainly in the UK currently. The question is this tangible? Are they? There's a lot of talk about this. Are they actually implementing different systems so that you know, we can have local control, or if the next pandemic hits, we are better prepared? Or is it just talk, or are people actually putting money in, investing in projects that will help domestic food security?
And that's, as far as I'm concerned, a really massive question. Will the funds be available to build up local production so that it is viable, so that it is of adequate quality, so that it responds to people's needs, so that it produces food at reasonable cost? And the answer is that in many cases that takes time, that requires investment, and sometimes it requires even protecting local markets so that they can't be undercut by imports from elsewhere. That needs government attention, it needs cash, and it needs a kind of single-minded political support. It's very, very hard to do that gentle protection if you haven't got the political support. And you have to look over your shoulder. It's this sort of protection of local production is only permitted by the rules of the World Trade Organization for a certain amount of time under certain conditions. And then if you go on too long, then you can be in trouble in the WTO procedures. And so all I would say is that it's a great thing for any country to be aiming for right now is increased capacity for resilience, but it requires quite a lot of good governance to get there, and not everybody is in a position to do that. In particular, quite a lot of the places that are trying to increase resilience, small islands or landlocked countries and so on, they're also saying, oh, we haven't got the cash, and we could perhaps go delve into what are the problems about accessing cash for this sort of thing, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about one of your specific pieces of work. You co-authored a 2018 paper, Food Systems for Sustainable Development: Proposal for Profound Four-Part Transformation. Let's hear a little bit about this. Can you share us the key points in the paper and your thoughts that you have on building a global food system that is truly sustainable?
In 2012. I was working for the Secretary General of the United Nations. I'd been involved with him in examining what are the issues in food globally. And our main conclusion was that we've got to join things up. We've got to join up from production through to processing, to consumption, nutrition, health, the environment, climate, women and youth and the others who are involved, and just recognize that when you really look at it carefully, food touches just about every aspect of human existence. And yet when you hear people talk about food, you could be excused for thinking that that notion of food touching everything is wrong, because so much of the discussion about food really hones in on production. And that's super important. You need to have a whole farming community or a fishing community or livestock rearing community or more in order to get the food that we need. But it's not just about production. When we were working in 2012 to try to understand the dimensions of food, we developed the concept that food needed to be approached as a system and a systems issue. Food connects people with each other. Food connects people with the planet. And we started to ask the question, as the world moved towards much more ambitious goals for the future, what we call the sustainable development goals, we started to move towards a vision of what working on food would be involving in the medium to long-term future. And we said, focus on four key purposes of the food production systems. One, it's about livelihoods. There are about 2 billion people out of the nearly 8 billion people in our world whose livelihoods depend on food production and processing. There's huge variation. Some of them are super poor, what we call smallholder farmers, and even poorer are the labourers without land who work on farms. And they are therefore some of the most disadvantaged people in our world. We need to, as part of the transformation, focus on their livelihoods. Then at the same time, food production is one of the most destructive influences on environments and is the most important cause of the destruction of nature, particularly rainforests. It's also food production damages rivers and oceans with the runoff of fertilizers and other products used in food production into water. So we've got to focus on the link between food and environments and encourage what we call nature positive production. Thirdly, food contributes to about one third of greenhouse gas emissions, which are responsible for global warming and climate change. So therefore, we need to find ways of reducing the greenhouse gas emissions. For example, methane from livestock or from rice paddy, or carbon that's produced as a result of energy use in food production. And then fourthly, food production and food consumption is super important for determining people's nutrition. And their nutrition determines, particularly when they're young, how their heads are working, how their bodies are functioning. And do you know that almost half of the deaths in some parts of the world at the moment can be linked to what people eat? And indeed, one of the biggest costs of our food system, a negative cost, is its impact on people's long-term health. And there's a link between diet and diabetes and diet and heart disease. So if we could pay attention to the nutrition consequences of food, that would have a huge impact. Our four-part transition that we proposed, following the work that was done on food in within the Sustainable Development Agenda, was let's focus on livelihoods. Let's focus on nature-positive production. Let's focus on reducing the impact of food production on climate. And let's focus on nutrition and improving people's nutrition. That's the four-part transformation that we advocated. And it's become embedded in the work that was done in the 2021 UN Food Systems Summit, and it continues to be relevant to this day.
And in terms of innovations and change, I wonder what you think about the current slate of innovations that are talked about a lot. So I'm thinking alternative proteins, blockchain implementation, precision fermentation, cultivated meat, algae protein, vertical farming. Now, I mean, what you've been talking about are very systemic, fundamental issues. But do any of these individual technologies float your boat? Do you think that they're going to be a part of the solution to the problems we're facing?
There is quite a community of people who are looking hard for what they call game-changing solutions. They change the rules of the game. An example in climate change. There are people who say we will find it so hard to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from energy or from agriculture that we need to find alternatives, new techniques for capturing carbon and sequestering it. And that would be a game-changing solution. It basically means that we don't have to worry so much about altering how we do things now because some new magic technique will come along and help us out. A bit like vaccines against COVID that appeared early in 2021. Now, I want to say to you that I think that many of the challenges in our food systems are not going to be resolved through magic, game-changing innovations. There will be some, but almost by the very nature of things, we won't know in advance which those are. But most of the issues in food systems will need to be worked at over time as long-term challenges. Most of them will be dealt with through dialogue and debate among people working on food. Most of them will be dealt with through efforts to redistribute power so that it's not just a small number of people who control what's going on. They will be changes that are achieved through alterations in the human structures and involvement in food systems rather than the development of a new seed type or a new fermentation technology, or lab-produced meat and so on. That's where I sit. I'm saying that fundamentally, the things that need to change will be done through people and people working together and some kind of power shift rather than new tech.
I'm struck by the language you use, because it's very similar to when people talk about diets. Everyone is after a magic bullet. The truth is, it's hard work. It's systemic change. it's more
like everybody. I keep hoping for a magic bullet. I want a magic bullet to let my hair grow. But you know, I'm not going to find that. And that's the sort of funny thing about life. We keep hoping that there will be something that will come along that can get a result without having to work like anything and have all the trial and error. I've not found that happening too often in my life.
Yeah, we'll work on the hair thing. Now, obviously, we talked a lot about people's willingness to change and emotional resilience to change and things like that. Now, the Institute of Global Health Innovation and the Graham Institute have formed Climate Cares, a team of researchers, policymakers, educators working to understand and support mental health in the ecological crises. From this research, do you feel that the majority of people do have the capacity to work towards change? I mean, you're a big fan of the human. You know, humans are brilliant, you said. And what about their capacity to work towards change? Because a lot of the things that we've talked about will involve, big fundamental shifts in lifestyles.
You see, my basic position is that it is within the capacity of the human being to really work to handle, I'm not really saying to solve, but to manage all the tricky problems that we have, from bad wars through to climate change, through to destruction of nature, through to migration. But that does call for really quite big shifts in the way in which we all work together. And I'm super aware that for many that is just apparently just not possible. For many people, that the future does look a bit bleak. They're saying, I just don't think that people are going to be able to work together across nations, given the big disputes that we have, what we call the geopolitical challenges right now. And so they do tend to get a bit depressed about the future. And on climate change and on nature, there's even a term being coined for being anxious about the future. It's called eco-anxiety. And at the beginning, I think many of us thought that that was, okay, just a small number of people. But then quite over the last 10 years, but growing, we've seen that there is a lot more research appearing which suggests that large numbers of people are affected by anxiety about the future with regard to some of the very complex challenges that are faced. So climate change, certainly, destruction of the environment, certainly, but also anxiety about what I've just said, migration, and anxiety about diseases, having just lived through a pandemic. It wasn't a very nice one. And it's still bubbling away. It's not completely gone. So that also led to anxiety. Now, these existential challenges really need to be addressed by humans in an open-minded and constructive way. But if people are getting very down, and young people in universities are finding that they are just not ready to go ahead, or we're hearing that people are even deciding not to have children because they really are a bit sad about the future, then we need to do something about it. And that calls for quite substantial work in communities to help people live with their anxiety and ideally to help them overcome it. Not by medicalizing it, but actually by creating support structures in society that help us to hold together. Because the big challenge in modern societies is that sort of isolation of people, particularly as they're getting older. And so the work that's being done in the Institute of Global Health Innovation at Imperial College, where actually I'm privileged to have this role, is about helping groups in society to be better able to anticipate the future and to work in the future and to avoid being paralyzed by this kind of anxiety. That's what we're working on. It's the most intriguing subject. We're trying to understand how this fits into the research agenda for the future, whether it's in mental health or in climate change. But we're also trying to work out with others what are the social interactions that we're going to need to have in order to reduce the risks that we're paralyzed by the challenges of the future. That's what Climate Cares is all about, and that's what we're doing in partnership with many other groups all over the world, because it's too big a challenge to be dealt with by one group alone.
Yeah. And looking at those challenges, so food industry emissions need to be reduced by 45% by 2030, which is a mere 7 years away, and they've got to reach net zero by 2050. Is this realistic? Do you think the industry itself is doing enough to achieve these goals? And is it realistic at all to think that the industry will invest themselves, or is it fanciful without regulation, legislation and taxation? Is this going to be led by politicians working on behalf of the voter, the people with climate anxiety, with their own cares about what's happening to the world? Or does the industry itself need to do it?
When I talk to business leaders who are involved perhaps in food production or processing or distribution and retail, a proportion of them, I would say the enlightened, will say to me, we read the writing on the wall. We know we're going to have to change. We're going to have to reduce our emissions. We're going to have to be much better at regenerating nature, and we're going to have to produce products that, when they're consumed as indicated, don't endanger people's health. Now, I would say that that's a small proportion of those working in the food sector, but it's a significant proportion, and we hear them louder. And it's not just the companies. It's the people who invest in the companies, that large investment funds and venture capital funds. They're beginning to say, please, if you're using our money to invest, don't invest in things that are subsequently going to embarrass us because they're going to be found to be unhealthy or bad for the planet. So it's starting, but it's not anything like enough to really help us to get to where things need to get to. People are beginning to ask for it. Of course, they may not necessarily reflect in their requests all the complexities that we're experiencing, but they say simple things which are important to them, like, could we use less pesticides? Or could we not be eating so much red meat because it's a very inefficient way of eating the nutrients we need? And that's building up, and it's coming sometimes even to the point where it makes a difference in elections, and you get a big wave of, for example, those who are thinking they want more sustainable food systems. And then governments, of course, are looking at this because it's vital that they get the balance right. And then what it really means is it's a whole of society effort, and it doesn't move in a nice steady way, and you get a situation like we have at the moment with the food insecurity linked to the cost of living crisis, and the alarm bells go off in the minds of politicians. They whoop, we can't afford to go on being green, or we can't afford to go on being nutritious. We must concentrate on having more food, because otherwise the shelves will be empty. And so you thought you were moving towards more environmentally sustainable food systems, and that's slowed down. So it's never a smooth progression, but it's happening, and it's happening because we've got groups coming together and saying this is what we want to do together. And I know it sounds as though perhaps I'm being a bit magical, but I'm not, because I've got the opportunity to study what's happening around the world, And in some of the poorer countries, and some of the countries that are most affected by climate change, actually the urge to do something about food systems is the greatest. It's perhaps less profound in some of the wealthier countries where the different groups are quite entrenched. And there what you've got is more conflict, whereas in poorer countries we're really seeing a real move towards trying to shift food systems so they are more sustainable, more resilient, and more equitable.
Very good. OK. Now, I've got to ask you a question about COVID. I'm sure you're bored sick of talking about it. But
no, I love it.
The WHO, thank God.
I do love it because it's never-endingly tricky.
Absolutely. Well, the never-ending aspect is what I want to ask about, because the WHO says it's no longer a global health emergency.
Public health emergency of international concern.
Yeah.
A most incredible acronym when you say it quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, and life is beginning to return to normal. The big question really is, are we well enough prepared for either another outbreak or a new pandemic? Where are the weaknesses, and what is the big work that still needs to be done?
Whenever you've got these diseases, you've usually got a virus or a bacterium that's causing the trouble. And my basic line, ever since I started working on disease control in 2005, has always been that virus or bacterium is the problem, people are the solution. And if people are the solution, then the role of authorities at all times has to be to find ways to engage people as partners in addressing the disease challenge. And when I've met leaders who actively engage people and organise their whole approach to responding to disease as one that is bringing people along in the response and levelling with them in an authentic way, communicating with them regularly, treating them as though they are part of the response, then things go much better. So for me, being prepared is not just about stockpiles of vaccines or tests or even hospital beds where people can be put when they're sick. It's also about preparing societies for threats about which there will be many unknowns, and just making sure that there's a measure of trust and understanding between the authorities and the people. And for me, that is what preparedness is about. Trust building, testing, doing exercises, talking with each other in an open way afterwards. How's it gone? What did you feel? Recognising these are scary situations for people and not everybody feels the same. Helping people to make sense of what's going on because everybody sees these things differently. That is preparedness. If I had my way, I would be having organised dialogues in multiple settings, not controlled by me, but just the opportunity for dialogues about disease control in as many places as possible. I'd be encouraging learning across from one place to the other, one location, one country to the other, one community to the other. That's what preparation for me has to be. And I've seen it done when I was involved in pandemic preparedness, really in the United Nations and then with governments, particularly in the period 2005 to 2015, when we were worried then about bird flu becoming a pandemic. I was able to be involved in a lot of dialogues, particularly in poorer countries, and I think that served us well. I want to ask everybody not to assume that preparedness is just about how much what we call PPE or protective equipment have you got in store. One of the big problems about protective equipment is that it can go bad over time. So you end up with out-of-date protective equipment. Very embarrassing politically when you have to burn masks and so on. So I really would like to suggest that we make preparedness about preparing groups of people. Are we doing it right? Well, I'm not sure we are. Here's what's happened. COVID was full of so many uncertainties that every time an outfit like the World Health Organization tried to offer guidance, there would also be people in countries who said, don't believe you, you're wrong. And some of these people got really quite angry and said, you're not only wrong, you're criminally wrong. And it was quite tough for the public health people in outfits like the World Health Organization to have a clear communication. Of course, the people who got really mad angry with us were quite a minority, but they made a lot of noise, particularly on social media. And when you get presidents supporting that sort of stuff, which we had in one or two cases, that makes it particularly challenging. I want to therefore say that as well as getting public discourse about what's going on, I think that the other main thing we have to do to prepare things is to really work on the politics and the relationship between political leaders. And that means creating space for political leaders to come together. What the WHO has done is encourage negotiation between political leaders on a pandemic preparedness treaty. And that's great stuff. It's going to need time. It's going to need a lot of space for confidence to be built, and that should get it right. So dialogue amongst the public, please stimulate it, and working between heads of nations on a new treaty for pandemic action, absolutely vital. And I just hope that the geopolitical tensions won't become so strong that they make it almost impossible for the world to work together on the next pandemic.
Beautifully put. Well, let's hope they get off their asses and actually talk and implement these things. My last question then is just simply this. I'm struck by your energy and your enthusiasm and your excitability in the face of seemingly insurmountable problems and issues which are dire and desperate. You sound like an optimist to me. Are you an optimist or a pessimist or a realist?
Gosh, if only I could define myself in terms of these polls when you're putting up these questions. I'm a realist. I'm a believer in humanity and I love people. I know that in any community, there are majority of people who are just great and there occasionally be a few people who are less great. And so I want to work with those who are preparing for the future. I want to connect with those who are really trying to undermine that energy. And that gives me just the will to go on because I love working with people. I think I probably love people. And that is the most defining thing about me. And within that, I have a huge amount of belief in the power of people. And that, I think, makes me more of an optimist than a pessimist. But probably like you, Stefan, I look at the news and I read about some of the horrible things that can happen, whether it's violent conflict, which I abhor, or whether it is really massive suffering because a boat has sunk somewhere and it's got a lot of people stuck in the hold. That gives me huge despair. So it makes me sometimes ask myself, you know, are we actually going to be able to pull ourselves out of some of these scrapes? So like everybody, I have my down moments and I have my up moments. But overall, I have a profound belief in the brilliance of the human being and the capacity of humans together to solve just about any challenge that comes along. And so I'm continuing in that way. I suppose I'll go on probably until my brain stops working.
Well, it's been a huge privilege to briefly bathe in your expertise. I also have to say on behalf of myself and all of our listeners that to just thank you so much for the work you've done. And please don't stop.
I like that. Do you know, I love song titles or things that could be song titles coming up in these sorts of things. So please don't stop. I'm sure that's a song title.
David Nabarro, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.